Hello everyone, and welcome back to Daily Kaylee's 13 Days of Halloween. It has been a little bit since my last episode. It's been a little over a week. I spent all of this previous week sick. I have not done anything besides clean my house, take care of my kids, and sleep when humanly possible. So, even though I've been feeling better for the past few days, as you can probably still tell, my voice is not normal. I still have a sore throat. I've got like a yucky mucus situation going on, but I am ready to get back to 13 days of Halloween. I say it every year. I say it in every episode. This is my absolute favorite thing about this podcast, about this time of year, about my life in general. I live for 13 days of Halloween. Today's episode is super exciting, actually, because it is a double feature. I have done a double feature in a sense a couple times before, but usually I am just uploading two separate episodes and I call that my double feature, which technically it is. But tonight I wanted to do something a little different, a little bit more fun, and this episode will be split into two parts, but it will all be in this one episode. I'll give you a little break in between so we can rest for a second, go to the bathroom, do all of the things. But the first part of today's episode is about the Monster of Florence. This case is very interesting. They actually have multiple movies based on this serial killer, either directly based off of this killer or loosely based on these events. The Monster of Florence has never been identified. As I'm sure you can infer from his name, he was active in Florence, Italy. The Monster of Florence was active between 1974 and 1985. It's been debated on if he was active earlier than 1974, but the first confirmed victim that is without a doubt the Monster of Florence. It happened in 1974. That was a really long way of explaining that to you. Anyways, as I said, he's never been identified. Within these 11 years, he murdered 14 people, and his victims were usually young couples. Each of these young couples were murdered in the privacy of the woods, and they were usually, as one can imagine, for young people, they had snuck off to have a private, intimate moment together. Most of his victims were also murdered during new moons, which is one very interesting piece of this case. There have been sketches done of the suspect, but once again, as I said, he has never been identified or brought to justice. Over the course of many years, Italian law enforcement have done multiple different investigations, and they have, I won't say narrowed it down, because like I said, they still don't know who the Monster of Florence is, but throughout their investigations, they have been able to charge multiple different people with similar murders. It is determined that all of the Monster of Florence's murders were part of a larger group of double homicides. four of the victims. Well, eight of the victims, four of the murders, if that makes sense. They're double murders, so four different cases. They were able to track down two other people that were involved. So the Monster of Florence did not work alone. As I was saying just a second ago, I'm not going to say they narrowed it down because they still haven't found him, but they were able to figure out that it was a group of murderers that were working together on many of these murders. They referred to this group as the Snacks Companions. I don't know why, but I do know that is the direct translation of what they called this group of murderers in Italian. There were multiple weapons used for these murders. One was a knife, and one of the others was a .22 caliber Beretta, which is a handgun, if you don't know. In half of the cases, the female victims had their sex organs cut out of their body. And this appeared to be the main motive of the crime. Like I said, this only happened in half of the murders. Very strange, I know. Let's get into the specific murders, the victims, the cases, and let me give you all the details. As I said, most of the people he killed were young couples, which makes sense. The first confirmed murder. Okay, before I get into this case, I want to put a little disclaimer in here, like I do for many of these episodes. I do not speak Italian. I speak a couple other languages, but Italian is definitely not one of them. It's a beautiful language, but I can't figure it out. If I absolutely butcher these names, I want everyone to know I am very sorry. I'm trying my best. I've written them down, but I have absolutely taken no notes on pronunciation for any of these names, like an idiot. So I'm going to try. We're going to rough it out together. Okay. Disclaimer over. Back to the case. The first confirmed murder was on the night of the night of August 21st, 1968. Like I said, it is suspected this could be the beginning of the other murders. It is speculated. I will let you determine. So, August 21st, 1968, Antonio Lobianco, he's 29, and Barbara Locci, who is 32, were shot to death with a .22 caliber handgun in Signa, which is a small town right outside of Florence. They were attacked in their car. In the back seat of the car was Barbara's son, Natalino. He was 6 and he was asleep. He was unharmed. When Natalino woke up and saw that his mother was dead, he ran because he was terrified. He ran until he reached a house 2 kilometers away and he went for help. Barbara was well known in town. She had a nickname in town, which I don't know if this was all in good fun or if people disliked her, but they called her Queen Bee. I feel like that could go either way. She had an older husband at the time, and his name was Stefano. He was actually eventually charged with this murder, and he spent 6 years in prison. I can see why they would suspect him. I understand the motive. I guess it was suspected he caught his wife with a younger man, and there you go. However, while Stefano was in prison, another couple was murdered with the exact same handgun. Barbara had many lovers, so they had a whole list of suspects. Multiple of them were suspected to be the perpetrator of the crime. They never really figured out who it was. Even Stefano, while in prison, said that it had to be one of them that killed her. Like, it wasn't him. There was no evidence found, even though other murders were being committed, while all of his people had been arrested at various times. It was never figured out. In 1982, these murders of Antonio and Barbara, they were linked to a more recent string of murders based on a tip from an anonymous writer who had signed himself in Italian, but the English translation is a friendly citizen. They wrote this letter to the police stating what they believed, I guess, linking these crimes. On July 20th, 1982, there was a file found that was inappropriately stored. It was some records of Stefano's case file. Inside of the record in the file were 5 bullets and 5 shell casings. Because this was about, 14 years later, they were unable to, trace back the chain of command for who had this evidence. Who filed the evidence, whose hands it passed through. They didn't get that. However, they should have checked to see if these casings matched the report from the original murder. Because these empty shell casings were fired by a gun that were used in 4 similar crimes since 1968, the casings inside of this case file suggested to the police that the perpetrator of the more recent murders was connected with the police and with this file. They were not supposed to be there. They were hidden there. Like I said, it's speculated because the investigation was very sloppy. You can do with that information what you will, and keep that in mind as we go through the rest of the cases. On September 15th, 1974, this is the first confirmed murder. I misspoke earlier, but I think I cleared that up. On September 15th, 1974, 2 teenagers, Pasquale Gentilcore, he was 19, and Stefania Patini, who was 18, were shot and then stabbed in a country lane near Borgo San Lorenzo, right outside of Florence. They were murdered in the middle of having sex in Pasquale's car. They were not far from this, a club, basically. It was called Teen Club. You can imagine dancing, making out, gross. Anyways, they were supposed to hang out there with their friends. They weren't very far. When their bodies were found, Stefania's corpse had been violated with a grapevine stalk, and she had been disfigured with 97 stab wounds. Just a few hours before the murder, Stefania had talked to one of her close friends about this weird man that was scaring her to death. Another friend of Stefania's recalled that a strange man had followed and bothered both of them during a driving lesson just a few days before the murder. Could have been the same person she was talking about with the other friend. Multiple other young couples came forward and spoke and said that these people used to also park in the same area where Pasquale and Stefania were murdered. And they claimed that there had been multiple different weirdos that would come to watch kids. And some of them acted very oddly. Could have been one of them that murdered Stefania and Pasquale. On June 6, 1981, Giovanni Foggi, 30 years old, and Carmela DiNuccio, 21, were shot and stabbed. Giovanni's body was pulled out of the car. And, no, I misspoke. I wrote this down wrong. It was not Giovanni. Carmela's body was pulled out of the car, and the killer cut out her entire pubic area with a notched knife. The next morning, a man by the name of Enzo Spalletti, who was 30, he spoke about the murder before the corpses had been discovered. He was kind of one of those weirdos who like to watch people have sex in public. Like the ones from the parking lot in the last case. He obviously at least watched it happen and did not step in. He knew specific details about the murder, regardless if he was the one to have murdered them or not. It was proven that he was not the murderer because he was arrested after speaking of the murder with these details. He spent 3 months in jail and was absolutely going to go down for these murders. However, the real murderer killed again while Enzo was in jail. Therefore, it could not have been Enzo. On October 23rd, 1981, Stefano Baldi, 26, and Susanna Camby, 24. They were engaged. They were in love. They were shot and stabbed in a park. Susanna's pubic area was cut out just like Carmela from the last case. The morning after the murder, an anonymous caller called her mother and claimed they wanted to talk to her about her daughter. Just a few days before the murder, Susanna had told her mom that there was somebody tormenting her and chasing her in a car. Reminds you of the first case we talked about. On June 19th, 1982, Paolo Minardi, 22, and Antonella Migliorini, 20, were shot to death just after having sex in Paolo's car. This time, the killer did not have time to mutilate Antonella or cut out her pubic bone. This road was relatively busy. They were parked like on the side of a city road. There were several passing vehicles and motorcycles that had seen the car parked at the side of the road. And the interior light of the car had been turned on. Because of the nature of this road, the police were called, and Paolo was actually still alive when he was found, but he died in the hospital just a couple hours later. So there was nothing he could really say to identify the vehicle. He was able to say that he heard or he saw the killer approaching and he tried to drive away, but he lost control of the car because of his hurry and he drove the car into a ditch on the other side of the road. He did not come out and say this is what happened, but based on the very little speech that he had, he tried to convey this story. Piecing together the details, the police also thought that maybe Paolo was not able to actually drive the car away, that he had attempted to and was shot before he could actually move the car. They then believed that maybe the killer got in the car and drove it into the ditch to try to hide the car. And it could go either way, honestly. On September 9th, 1983. These are the names that are really going to do me in, because these are German names. And one language I definitely cannot speak is German. I will take Italian any day over German. I'm trying. Okay. September 9th, 1983. Wilhelm Friedrich Horstmeier, 24. And Jens U. Rusch, 24. There were two students visiting from Germany, hence the German names, and they were visiting Italy. Apparently, Wilhelm had just received a really big scholarship, so they were kind of celebrating. It was like a celebratory trip. However, they were found shot to death in their bus. These were both men, by the way. I know the names could probably go either way. But it was an interesting case for the police. It is believed that because of Jen's he had long blonde hair and he was kind of small. It was believed that they were targeted because the killer thought Jen's was female. It is also confirmed that Jens and Wilhelm were lovers based on pornographic materials they found at the scene. Like, they had obviously gotten in their bus and driven to this area to have an intimate private moment, like all of the other couples. On July 29th, 1984, Claudio Stefanici, who was 21, and Pia Gilda Rontini, who was 18, they were shot and stabbed to death in Claudio's Fiat, which was parked in a woodland area. The killer carved out Pia's pubic area and her left breast. There were reports of a strange man who had been following this couple at an ice cream shop just a couple hours before the murder. A close friend of Pia's also recalled that she had told her she had been bothered by some unpleasant man while she had been working at the bar that she was employed by. On the night of September 7th into the early morning hours of September 8th, 1985, John Michael Cravatvilli, wrote that down wrong, 25, and his girlfriend, Nadine Mario, 36, they were French, and they were visiting Italy. They were camping in the woods, and they were shot and stabbed while they were sleeping in their tent. John Michael was killed a short distance away from the tent because he was trying to escape. He was running. Nadine's body, however, was mutilated. Because they were from France and they were not Italian citizens, there was not a missing persons report. Their families in France, their friends in France, they're like, yeah, they're visiting Italy. There's no reason to suspect that something has gone wrong until they don't come home. However, despite there not being a report, this seemed to only piss off the killer. He sent a taunting note along with a piece of Nadine's breast to the state prosecutor, stating that a murder had been taking place and basically challenging local law enforcement to go find these victims. An innocent citizen, picking mushrooms in the area, discovered the bodies just a few hours before the letter arrived on the prosecutor's desk. And those are the cases. It was not until Antonio Foggi and Carmela DiNuccio's murder in 1981 that the police finally realized these killings were definitely connected. After this murder, they tested the weapons, they tested the shell casings at the scene, and confirmed it was the same gun that had been used in both murders. It was at this time that the killer was deemed the Monster of Florence. After the 1982 murders, police leaked false information saying that Minardi had regained consciousness before dying in the hospital, basically to scare a suspect into doing something incriminating, to think that he had spoken and he could identify the suspect, basically. Soon after this, an anonymous tip called for the police to look back into the LoBianco and Loci murder from 1968. The first one that I said is debated on whether or not it's related. It was determined the same gun had been used. And this is when they kind of realized Stefano couldn't have murdered his wife and her lover. And it was just a very strange case. However, when they were going back through the files, they were going over his statements. All of his statements and his police interviews were inconsistent. He would shift the blame. It was just very interesting. A former lover of Barbara Loci, by the name of Francesco Vinci, was arrested first. His car had been found hidden the day that the false information about the Minardi case had been leaked, which was kind of interesting. They kept Francesco in custody for over a year, even during the 1983 murders, when it could not have been him. After they did some more research, some more investigating, they also brought in Stefano's brother and brother-in-law, Giovanni Mele and Piero Mugurini. While all three of these suspects were in custody, the 1984 murders happened. At this point, they had to release all three. There was really no more they could do. They could not pin these murders on any of these people. After this, they focused the investigation on Francesco's brother, Salvatore Vinci. He was also a former lover of Barbara. She gets around. Once again, in 1985... there was nothing. There was absolutely nothing. The main reason that they wanted to investigate Salvatore, besides him being a lover of Barbara, is because his wife had died in a fire, and it was ruled a suicide, but it was rumored to be a murder. So they kind of wanted to look into this. They could not pin him with the murders of Barbara. So what they did do was try to charge him with the murder of his wife, because they thought, okay, if we can get this turned into a conviction, we can pin these other murders on him. It'll look more realistic that he was the perpetrator. However, that trial did not go in the police's favor. He was acquitted and he walked free. After this, there's a couple other suspects, but none of them are linked to Stefano, Barbara's husband. With the anonymous tip and computer analysis, they brought in a new suspect, Pietro Paciani. He was convicted for both rape and abuse of his two daughters, and for the murder of a man in 1951 who had a relationship with his ex-girlfriend. He served 13 years in prison for this murder. There were a few similarities between the 1951 murder and the current killing. It was very interesting. The only physical evidence against him was an unfired bullet that was the same brand as the gun from the Monster Florence killings, and it was found in his garden after they searched his home and his property. Pietro was controversially convicted in his first trial in 1994. It's a very interesting trial. He appealed because he claimed his innocence. And at his appeal, the prosecutor actually took his side. They cited lack of evidence, poor police work. Basically, they called the police out for just trying to pin this murder on somebody to say it's over. He was acquitted and he was released. A new trial for Pietro was ordered by the Supreme Court in the late 90s. However, Pietro died in 1998 before this trial could begin. Because they were so intent on closing this case, after Pietro's death, they had two of his alleged accomplices tried instead. Mario Vanni and Giancarlo Lotti. Vanni had been a witness at Pietro's trial, and he claimed two of them to be picnic companions. This is where the name snack companions comes from later. That's just the beginning of it. Lotti had been one of the surprise witnesses, and according to Lotti, he said he saw Pietro and Vanni commit the 1985 murder. Because he was questioned so many times before the trial, he actually incriminated himself as well. Both of them were convicted and sentenced to life in prison. However, because two of them were convicted for only one murder, a lot of people still consider this to be unsolved, and it's not good enough. This is not a good enough explanation. And I agree. In 2001, a chief inspector for the police announced that these crimes were connected to a satanic cult that was supposedly active in Florence. It's insane. According to Lotti in his testimony, he had apparently spoken to a doctor who had hired Pietro to commit the murders and collect the sex organs of these women to use for satanic rituals. I don't know how to say this respectfully, but I think this is bullshit. I think they're grasping for straws. The cult activities were verified by a pyramid-shaped stone near where Pietro had worked. And according to the chief of police, this stone was indicative of cult activity. It was a symbol for cult activity. They searched the area that Pietro worked. They searched quite a bit of that area, and they found nothing. So like I said, I still think this is bullshit. More researchers and investigators have speculated, and one of the other interesting ones is from 2017. It was by a freelance investigative journalist. His name was Francesco Amicone, and he actually, in his research, found a connection between the Monster of Florence and the Zodiac Killer. And I think it is very interesting. His suspect is a former superintendent of the Florence American Cemetery in Italy. His name is Joseph Bevilacqua, but he goes by Giuseppe. So we'll call him Giuseppe. Giuseppe was born in 1935 in New Jersey. He had a 20-year career in the army, and he actually left the army to move to Florence in 1974. Francesco wrote an account of Giuseppe's partial admission, in which he supposedly confessed to Francesco of being responsible of the murders for both the Zodiac Killer and the Monster of Florence. And this was an unregistered conversation, so basically there's no proof. When this was published in 2018, Giuseppe denied that this happened. He threatened with a lawsuit, but Francesco did not stop accusing him. He did not stop claiming that this happened. Francesco went on in 2021, and he claimed that they had the conversation and he had proof. He said that Giuseppe would have been an undercover agent assigned to an investigation in San Francisco. At the time of the Zodiac killings, between 1969 and 1970, he would have been in San Francisco. Because Giuseppe was an army criminal investigator, Francesco says that Giuseppe would have had access to a case file of a double murder near Florence in 1968, where these bullets in this casing have been improperly stored. He moved to Florence in 1970, and he left the army to move to Florence, but while he was still in the army, he was a criminal investigator. So it is believed he could have gotten access to these files. It is just, it's mind-boggling. But let me finish. There's just a little bit more about this case. Because of Francesco's accounts and his journaling, and because he absolutely swore this guy was the killer, in 2020, the Italian police actually took some of Giuseppe's DNA. In 2021, Francesco was, this was shot down. The attorney in charge of the investigation actually wrote a letter, like a legalized letter, saying Francesco's inquiry was closed. There was absolutely nothing factual about it. It was all just assumptions and suggestions. None of it was true. And that's it. Like, they have no other suspects. Like I said, the two men that were ultimately convicted, I just don't buy it. I consider this to still be an unsolved case like many others. That is the first part of our episode tonight. Let's take a break. I gotta pee. Let's pee. Let's get some water. Let's cozy up on the couch, and we will be back for part two. See you in a second. Alright guys, welcome back. Let's get into part two of tonight's episode, which is a very peculiar case, and it is about the Yuba County Five. If you've never heard of the Yuba County Five, you're in for a treat. This is a very mind-boggling case. This is the kind of case that will keep you up at night wondering what the hell happened. If you're not aware, the Yuba County Five refers to a group of five young men from Yuba City, California. Each of these men had some form of a mild intellectual disability or a psychiatric condition, mental illness, something like that. These five men were all friends. They enjoyed sports. They were actually on a community basketball team together that was sponsored by a local foundation that helps the mentally disabled. On the night they went missing, they were actually going to see a basketball game at California State University, which is in Chico, California. This game took place on the night of February 24th, 1978. After this basketball game, all five men went missing. Four of them were later found dead, and the fifth man, Gary Mathias, has never been found. Never, to this day, 45 years later. When they went to the basketball game, there was absolutely no reason for anyone, any of their parents, anyone to assume they were not coming home. All five men, because of their intellectual disabilities, still lived at home with their parents. All of their parents were aware they were going to the basketball game. Some of them had even reminded their parents they had to work the next day, so to like lay out their work clothes for them, so that they'd be ready for work tomorrow, like they were excited for the basketball game, they'd be home. It was not out of the ordinary. The next morning, when none of them had returned home, none of them had returned to work, that's when they were reported missing. Several days after they disappeared, their car, which was a Mercury Montego, it was found abandoned in a remote area of the Plumas National Forest. It was found on a very steep mountain dirt road. And it was definitely not on their way back home. This was completely out of the way. There was no reason they should be on the road. The investigators could also not determine why the car was abandoned. When the car was found, one of the windows was rolled down and the car was left unlocked. However, the keys were not in the car. So the first thought of the police was, okay, the car broke down, they took the keys to go get help, they were coming back for the car. When they jumped off the car, it started right away. There was nothing wrong with the engine, there was nothing wrong with the car. It still had a quarter tank of gas, there was no physical damage to the car, and it was actually determined after having the car examined and checked out that because there was no physical damage to the car with this bumpy dirt road, whoever was driving was either being extremely careful or, more likely, it had to have been someone who was familiar with the area, and none of these men were. Although they found the car in February, they did not find any of the men. There was no trace. It was snowy. It was winter. There was no trace of the men. After the snow was long gone, in June of 1978, four of the five bodies were found either inside of or outside of a trailer, which was used as backpackers, as like a shelter in a forest. It was 20 miles away from the car. The three bodies left out in the woods, the only thing that was found were their bones because of animals picking at the remains, the elements. However, the body that was found in the trailer, it belonged to Ted Wire, and he had apparently lived for as long as 3 months after they went missing. An autopsy determined he had starved to death, even though they had plenty of food and heating materials nearby. Ted was also missing his shoes, but they found Gary Mathias's shoes in the nearby woods, which also suggested that he had survived for some time beyond their last meeting, their last sighting. Later that day, a local man came forward And he claimed that he had also spent that night in his car a short distance down the road from where the car was found. He also told the police that he had seen and heard people around his car that night. He called for help twice and no one came. They turned off their lights and they did not help him. Very suspicious, and this is the main reason why foul play has been suspected for quite some time. A little bit of a background for Gary. He actually served in the army in the early 70s, and he was stationed in Germany. However, while he was in the army, he developed bad drug habits, and he was discharged from the army. He was actually diagnosed with schizophrenia, and he returned home to his parents in Yuba City. He began treatment. It was sort of a bumpy road ahead for him. But by 1978, he was doing really well. He's being treated for schizophrenia. He was doing pretty good. He met his new friends. He's doing great. All the other four men were slightly older than Gary. But like I said, they all had either a psychiatric disorder or an intellectual disability. And they all lived close by. They all lived with their parents. They hung out very often. They were always playing some kind of sport or watching a sports game. They loved basketball. This is just such a crazy case. I don't even know where to begin after this. I will say, Madruga, I'm going to refer to all of them as their last names because that is what I've got written down, and it's a lot easier than saying like, oh, Ted and Gary. It's a lot easier. Okay, Madruga, he was the only one besides Gary Mathias who had a driver's license. Therefore, he was the only one with a car. He had the Mercury Montego, like I said. And he drove them 50 miles north to Chico to watch the game. The only thing they had on to protect them for the cool weather was like a light coat. Just like a light coat you'd wear in the fall time. Not something you'd wear in snowfall in February if you're going hiking on a mountain. That's very important. After the game was over, they got back in the car and they drove just like a short distance into town to Bear's Market, which is basically a convenience store. They bought snacks, sodas, and milk. It was right before 10 o'clock, and this is when the store closed. Now, this is important, because this is the only reason the clerk remembered that they had been there, because she was annoyed that they were there so late. After leaving this convenience store with their snacks, none of the men were seen alive again. There's no further recollection of these men. Like I said, by the next morning, their parents reported them all as missing. It was very suspicious. It was not like them to not be home. The police initially searched the route that they took from Yuba City to Chico. They found absolutely nothing. Then a few days later, the forest ranger told investigators he had seen the car parked in the forest on February 25th. At the time, he had not considered this to be a big deal because a lot of people would park on the road and go hiking. They would go skiing. Like, it wasn't weird to see an abandoned car. However, when he saw the missing persons poster, he recognized the car and he thought, that is suspicious. So he called. Because of the state of the inside of the car, it was determined that these men had returned to the car after they were last seen. All of the wrappers for their food that they had purchased at the grocery store were inside the car. They had eaten and drank their snacks and they were left in the car. However, this didn't really help them because, like I said, it's 70 miles away from Chico, which is where the basketball game was. And it's nowhere near Yuba City. Nowhere near even, like, the route to go home. Like I said, there was no damage to the car whatsoever. And none of their families could determine why any of them would have been on this road with no extra clothing on when it was freezing and they were in high elevation. Apparently, to further what I was saying about how odd this was, Madruga's parents said he did not like cold weather and he'd never even been in the mountains. Sterling's father said when he was a child, he had actually taken him to near this area when he was younger to go fishing. But Sterling absolutely hated it and he remained home any other time his father went fishing. He was the only one who had been anywhere remotely near that area and he was a child. Madruga's parents also said that it was strange that when the car was found, the window was rolled down and it was unlocked because he was not someone to leave his car so unsecured, especially in the middle of nowhere like that. It's strange. Because of all of the snow and the bad weather, they stopped searching until June of the same year, as I said. After they put out a request asking for any information on these men, any sightings, they received several reports of one or all of the men being sighted after they had left Chico, and most of these were easily dismissed. But there was two sightings that seemed a bit interesting. Like I said, the local man, who I earlier said, slept in his car right down the road the same night. He had to stay in his car that night because he actually owns a cabin nearby. But while he was on his way to the cabin, he got stuck in the snow. In the process of trying to free his car from the snow, he had a heart attack. He was experiencing the early symptoms of a heart attack. So he got back in the car to rest and try to fight off his heart attack, basically. He was in the car all night. When he saw the first set of headlights, he noticed it was a car parked behind him and there was a group of people around the car. He said one of these people seemed to be a woman holding a baby. Like I said, he called out for help. He was having a heart attack. He needed help. They all stopped talking and turned off their headlights. Later, he saw more lights from behind him, and they were flashlights, not headlights. People were outside of their cars. He called for help once more, and they turned out their flashlights. Just very, very strange. Ted Wire's mother said that ignoring someone's help, like, need for help is not like him. That this cannot have been her son, or if it was, something was wrong. On March 3rd, another woman reached out to say she had seen four of the men. She said that four of them had stopped at the store in a red pickup truck the day after they had supposedly disappeared. The store owner confirmed her story. The woman that worked at the store said she realized they were not from the area because of their big eyes and their facial expressions, which is strange, but it is what it is. Two of the men were in a telephone booth outside of the store, and the other two went inside. The police took her account seriously. They deemed her a credible witness, and the store owner was actually able to give additional details based on their purchases. He said the two men came in the store and bought burritos, chocolate milk, and soda. However, this basically went nowhere. All of the evidence found, nothing really stood out. There was no for sure possibility that could be confirmed. They did believe, because of how weird it is, that foul play was probably involved here. When they found four of the five bodies, they were even more confused because none of them died from foul play. I mean, they died from hypothermia and starvation. But because Gary was never found, they thought, okay, maybe one of them was rescued, but he never turned up. On June 4th, they found the bodies. This trailer was about 20 miles away from where their car had been. The front window had been broken, which led police to believe they had to break in to get inside the trailer. When they opened the door, they could smell the body. It was a decaying body inside, and it was identified as Ted Wire. Over the next few days, they returned to the campsite, and they found the remains of Madruga and Sterling on opposite sides of the road, about 11 miles from where the car had been. It's believed that they were leaving the campsite and trying to head towards another shelter when they died. Madruga's body had been partially consumed by scavenging animals, like I said, and only bones remained of Sterling, and they were scattered by animals. Both of them died of hypothermia. 2 days later, Hewitt's father found his backbone under a bush, 2 miles north of the trailer. His shoes and his jeans were nearby, and the following day they found his skull. His death was also confirmed to be hypothermia. About a quarter mile away from the trailer, searchers found a Forest Service blanket and a rusted flashlight next to the road. It could not be determined how long they had been there, but it could have been from Gary Mathias. Because he had obviously not taken his medication, he'd been here for months, they sent pictures of him to mental institutions all over the state of California, and still no trace of him has been found. Inside of the trailer, Ted's body was on a bed with 8 sheets wrapped around it, including his head. The autopsy showed that he had died of starvation, like I said, and hypothermia. He lost nearly half of his body weight, so almost 100 pounds, and they used the growth of his beard to suggest he had lived as long as 13 weeks from when he had last shaved before the basketball game. His feet were extremely frostbitten. On the table next to his bed were some of his personal items, including his wallet, which had money still in it, a nickel ring that had his name engraved on it, and a gold necklace. Also on the table was a gold watch, which Ted's family said was not his, and it did not seem to be any of the other boys. There was also a partially melted candle. He was wearing a velvet shirt and lightweight pants. And, like I said, he had no shoes on, no socks, nothing. This is probably the most confusing piece of evidence of the whole case. They had no fire set in the trailer, and it had a fireplace. They had an ample supply of matches and paper that they could have used to start a fire. In the closet was heavy clothing, which could have kept them warm, and none of it had been touched. About a dozen ration cans from a storage shed outside of the trailer had been opened and eaten. However, inside of the storage shed was an even greater amount of dehydrated foods and like ration cans. And it was determined, they were counted, this food could have kept all 5 men fed for at least a year, and yet none of it had been touched. There was another shed nearby that had a butane tank that could have heated the trailer. It was just very strange. Ted's family said, however, that because of his intellectual and mental disability, he lacked common sense in a lot of things, and that this is probably why he had not used common sense in this case. However, it was strange considering there were four other men with him. It seemed that at least Gary and possibly Hewitt had been in the trailer with him because Gary's tennis sneakers were found in the trailer. The ration can had been opened with a P-38 can opener, which only Gary would know how to use because he worked in the military in Germany. The only explanation for why Gary's shoes were in the house and Ted's were missing is that Gary had taken Ted's shoes when he left. It's just so strange. There is really no real theory on what happened to these men. It was suggested that maybe they were going to visit friends because Gary had friends in a nearby town. Maybe they took a wrong turn and thought that they were still on the right track. I don't know. However, they seemed to know what they were doing when they got out of the car. And this is not consistent with people who genuinely believe that they are lost and have taken a wrong turn. It's just so confusing. This case is often referred to as the American Dyatlov Pass. If you know what that is, then you know. If not, I will talk about it on here one day. But the gist is that it was a case in Russia in the 50s when 9 hikers died under mysterious circumstances and they could not figure out what happened to them. And that's exactly how this case is. It is mind-boggling. After 45 years, Gary has still not been sighted. Like, not only has he not been identified and found, but there has been no trace of him. There's absolutely nowhere to begin searching for Gary Mathias. I hope you liked tonight's double feature episode. I will hopefully do more of these in the future. If you guys enjoyed it, let me know and I can plan that for us. But I'm so excited to be back with 13 Days of Halloween. And I will see you guys tomorrow for episode 8. Bye, guys. Yeah.